This car is the most honest car you ever see.
It's been a dream ever since I've had it.
The first time I heard that engine screaming, I thought, I gotta have one of those.
For me, the cars have personality.
What's great about a BMW Classic is the community that surrounds it.
When you listen to that, that's why we're here.
Welcome to Classic Heart, the BMW Group Classic Podcast. This is JP, and my guest today is Mike Burrows. You know him much better, I'm sure, for the thing he's doing in his garage under the name of Stains Works. So, Mike, welcome to our little podcast.
Thank you so much for having me. This is going to be a bunch of fun. I'm really excited to be a part of what you guys are doing here. And as a diehard BMW fan since day one, I couldn't ask for anything more. So thank you.
Where do we find you today? I assume it's early in the morning for you.
It is. It's bright and early. It's 8 a.m. here in sunny Southern California. I'm here at the office, at the shop. So I'm sitting at my remarkably messy desk. And for our camera setup this morning, it is clamped to an alternator that's sitting in front of me. I kid you not. So yeah, we're in it and we're doing it.
That's the perfect setup. So let me give some background for those 3 to 5 people who might not know you or never heard about you. So you are the founder of Stains Works. That's a little workshop that you created, and you do some amazing, is it fair to say, resto mods, or is that something you don't like to hear too much?
No, Restomod's totally fine. As far as exactly what Stains Works is, it's kind of a tough question to answer because it's kind of evolved and grown over the past, I hate to say it, but 15 years at this point.
Incredible.
It began really as just an automotive blog, a place for us to share content that, to be honest, was mostly BMW specific. That's kind of where I found my automotive roots. That's the first brand that really grabbed hold of me. And we built this huge, awesome community around vintage cars as a whole, but specifically around the BMW brand. And over the years, it's kind of grown from being that kind of online automotive magazine to what we're doing now, which is a YouTube channel. And so we're always working in the shop, just trying to showcase what really goes into project cars, really show the enthusiasm and kind of the nitty-gritty details as opposed to just snapping our fingers and saying, hey, look what got accomplished today.
I mean, modest as you are, I just can say that your YouTube channel has 23 plus million video plays since it has been created. I mean, that's an amazing number.
And it's really fun, in truth, to be able to monetize and make a living working on these cars that I'm so passionate about. It's what I think every car guy wishes they could do. And I'm fortunate to be out there every day. You know, as soon as we're done here, I'm going to walk back out there and start tinkering on an E30. And what's better than that? So,
but is it like nowadays you can say that Stains Works is really like your main business? Is that your profession?
Yes. So Stains Works has been a full-time job for me since, I think, technically November of 2011. That's when I moved out to California. I'm originally from Tennessee. And once I moved out here, that was kind of the, hey, let's do this for real. I had my business partner, Andrew Ritter, and we had a third partner at the time who said, hey, let's see what we can really build out of this brand. And it was kind of fun to see that happen based on just a small website I had started in my spare time while I was in college as a place to just kind of document what I was excited about.
So it's fair to say that Stains Works is not a one-man show anymore, in a sense. I mean, you're the face of that, right?
Yeah, I'm the face of Stains Works. And I guess in some ways, that's always been the case. For most of Stains Works' life, I had my business partner, Andrew Ritter. He and I finally kind of parted ways in 2018. And so from 18 up until halfway through last year, Stains Works was back to a one-man show. And then, yeah, give or take 6 months ago, I brought on my videographer, Anthony, who has made my life so much better, has made the quality of the channel so much better. He is just a rock star when it comes to this stuff, and he's been one of the best additions I've had to anything I've done. And so he's really changed the way I'm able to focus on my craft as I'm working, as opposed to, oh, I need to pick the camera up and set up this next shot, and then, oh, I need to move it around. How's the composition here? I can just focus on doing what I know I'm good at, and he can capture it, and it's a great team.
So how do you create your videos?
So there's no script. We've never scripted anything. And even down to our voiceover, it's all just ad-libbed, just kind of, you know, see what feels good as I'm watching the footage.
Mm-hmm.
The format is really just kind of coming up with our game plan for the week of what are we going to accomplish? Let's say maybe that's, oh, we're going to drop this engine into this car, or maybe we're going to get this one running. And the goal is just to get enough done to create at least some form of a compelling story, might be the wrong word, but something worth watching, not just a glimpse into it, not just, you know, a morsel. I want to make sure that whatever video I put out there is at least full in some sense. And I think that having a lack of a script, sometimes it might be detrimental to that, but I think it keeps it very real and authentic. I think it keeps it very relatable to the audience. Things go wrong. I mess stuff up. Sometimes you see the mishaps. I want to show what this stuff is really like. And I think not having a script helps that a lot.
I think that's the magic of all the video creators out there, also in that special field of working with cars and on cars, that you want to share that failure is evident. It happens to everyone. Nothing is perfect, as you just mentioned. And so I think the secret also to connect to people is being real. I mean, of course, being real does not exclude to mention some partners you have, which they're helping on your journey. It's like sponsoring partners or business partners. I think that's only fair. Plus, what you create is high quality content. That means you put a lot of effort and work in it.
I mean, it's a, you know, a real TV show length thing here. And doing that takes money. I mean, we've obviously got to pay ourselves. We got to, you know, be able to eat. We've got to pay rent on the shop. We've got to be able to make the cars themselves. We got to have the parts. We got to have the cars. We got to have the tools, you know, and this stuff is really expensive to do.
Yeah.
We've got a handful of really big sponsors on the channel. You know, for example, we've got H&R Suspension. We've got Sendcut Send. These guys come to the table and they really help make this whole thing happen bottom to top. Without them, there would be no channel at all.
We talked about business models and your YouTube channel, but let us get to know Mike a little bit better. So what's your background? Was your background in cars? Was it in design or in video shooting? Or what is your background?
So I suppose my background would be in photography. It's what I went to college for before I dropped out to do StanceWorks full time.
Oh, wow.
But interestingly, I only ever picked up a camera for the first time after I got my E36 that I still have. I wanted a way to photograph it and share it on the BMW forums. And the only way to do that was to pick up a camera and go take some photos. And so it was kind of cars and the visual media go together hand in hand for me. And they both really kind of started at the same time.
And so was there also a car background in the family, or were you the start of it?
No, it's certainly car background in the family. My mother and father, when they were together before I was born, ran an automotive ad agency for a long time.
Wow.
And so they both certainly get it. And my dad has had kind of car magazine feature cars and stuff back in the 80s. And so he's very much into it and gets it. But it almost feels genetic because I didn't grow up with my dad. My dad lived at minimum 8 hours away from me for almost my entire life. Then on the other hand, my stepfather was the presenter of Car and Driver and Motor Trend Television back in the 90s. And so to say he was into it as well is an understatement. We'd see cool cars on occasion. He'd come home in a Viper or, you know, the first NSX when it came stateside, things like that.
Ugh.
Cool to see as a kid, but only in that moment, right? After it was gone, for the most part, this was just stuff that my stepdad did and it was his work.
Yeah.
But it also feels like I got there through my own journey. I realized that I liked this car thing on my own and then got to pivot back and be like, hey, wait a second, both of you guys are into this too. This is pretty cool.
Mm-hmm. No, I think that's a meta layer, which like was constantly firing on your synapses with car content. So I think that's the result of it in a sense. But you made your very own idea of how to treat cars and what to do with cars. And you mentioned one BMW, which is very particular for you. Was it the first car you put the first time ever hands on and tried to recreate something?
So the first car that I ever really did anything with, technically, I bought an E30.
Mm-hmm.
It was an 87 325 IS. And I remember going to my stepdad and explaining I wanted to buy this car. I had found it on, you know, one of the, you know, paper car sale books they have at the gas station. Somebody had listed it, and this car was $250, which for me working at a dry cleaner at the time was a lot of money, you know? And he saw this thing and he said, a $250 BMW from the 80s, what are you thinking? This car is going to eat you alive. You'll never be able to afford to keep it on the road. It's going to be terrible. And he wasn't having it. So I actually sat down and I printed out all of these examples of how I thought I could afford this car. I showed him, oh, here's what an alternator costs. Here's what all, you know, all these different parts and pieces. Here's what brake pads and rotors cost. And I went to him with this pitch and I said, I can do this. You know, it was minimum wage at this dry cleaner, but I was like, you know, if I work and I save my money, I can afford to fix it. Can I please buy this thing? And so it was like, all right. So he finally conceded and said, all right, let's go get this thing. So we drove out. It was a long way away, a couple hours, I think. Mm-hmm. And we get there, and this car in retrospect was just, it was a pile. It was not a nice car. But we buy it, and it did drive home under its own power, but it had a completely blown up wheel bearing. So we drove home probably 30 miles an hour it took hours to get home, and it was in the pouring rain. It was a disaster, but it was so fitting to start out that way. I fixed the car up. I replaced some parts. I, you know, did all the maintenance things as I was really learning to wrench. It was the first time doing any of that kind of stuff. And then the first day that I drove it to school, the very first time I ever drove it, I got rear-ended and it totaled the car by a kid.
I mean, that must be horrifying. I mean, all the work you put into that, all gone within seconds on your first drive. What a shock.
I wish I could say that I was more torn up than I was. It was definitely a disappointment, but I hadn't put that much time into the car. Well, to be honest, once the car was totaled and I was looking at a $250 car with maybe a couple $100 of parts into it and then insurance saying, hey, we're going to give you, I think it was something like $6,000 for this car. That was more money than I'd ever seen. And it put that opportunity to get the E36 on the table for me. And I remember seeing E36s in magazines thinking, man, that's such a cool car. I will never be able to afford that because, I mean, we're talking about, this is the early 2000s. That car was new as recent as 99. So to be able to get that opportunity, because they were kind of coming down in price as some of them got older, being able to get that really early model 93 325 felt like just a blessing. And I'm really glad that it happened because I think that car has done so much for my career. So there's definitely no love lost on that car getting totaled. And in fact, I'm glad that it did. So,
but when we speak about like design, I mean, what is the, for you, of course, the E36 was the newer car and you were amazed by it and then the dream come true due to this fortunate accident, financially fortunate accident. But what would you say is for you the biggest difference in terms of standing and design between the E30 and the E36?
So I'll take a step back and answer this question in a really weird way by addressing a car that is neither of those, which is my favorite BMW, the E28. Mm-hmm. And I'm going to use this as an example to paint how I think that the E36 is different from it. The E28 and the E30 are very similar in the way that they are put together, in the way that they drive, minus things like weight and the way they deliver their power, and of course, the steering box versus rack. But what I love about the E28 and why it's my favorite car of all cars is that I think it represents this perfect balance between when technology came to a car and benefited it without holding it down in any way. It never made the driving experience digital. It was an analog driving experience that was aided through the use of digital tools like modern, you know, Bosch fuel injection and things like that, or even the design of the suspension and the way that the car works. Being able to use technology to make what feels like a classic car be the best version of that classic car, that's why I love the E28. It looks like a BMW is meant to look to me. I think it is exactly what a BMW should be. It's a perfect touring car. It can carry four people comfortably. It can storm down the freeway. It's light on its feet, despite being a sedan. It is what I love about this brand. Now, how does the E36 differentiate from that, or in your question, the E30? I think that it represents as technology came in and became more of an integral part of the car. Now, I'm probably the kind of guy who complains about that more often than I compliment it, but I think that the E36 did a lot of that stuff really well. And I have always said that the E36, I think, is the best driving car per dollar that money can buy.
Mm-hmm.
You can go out and you could buy a base model E36, and with minimal money put into it, you could have a real track weapon. And it is one of the fastest cars out there at the track every weekend. And it's a testament to how well that car drives. And I know a lot of guys with E36s that are just incredibly fast. Yet you tend to have things like Miatas or Corvettes or what have you that come to mind as these great bang for buck cars. And I think BMW guys will all agree that the E36 fits in that realm of a true performance powerhouse. Now, to your point earlier, the E36 is also definitely getting expensive. I remember when I was a kid saying these things will never be worth real money. They made too many of them, but it turns out that all of them that got sold for cheap have been turned into, you know, crap. And so the nice ones are worth something. There's not a ton of them out there to choose from. And so there's a little bit of sourness on my part watching all of these cars I got into as a kid because they were cheap turn into these expensive classics because everybody now appreciates them. But I guess that's just part of getting older. So
I think it's very interesting that you built a bridge back to the E28, which I think has this little, the one thing that BMW lost on this course of new designs is this shark nosy thingy. I think the E28 is the last one, which has this nice, can you call it slanted? I'm not sure. No, slanted is a different way, but like an angular way of seeing in the front. And I really love that. And so I definitely hear you when you say that the E28 has so much influence on the future design, even more than the more, let's be honest, the most popular one is the E30 because of the M3 glory at its time, in my opinion, and the DTM.
Of course.
But I think it's very interesting what you said, and maybe some of our listeners are now interested to dive into the E28 thingy. So what are your points? If you want to purchase an E28, what are your points where you should really take care of before you purchase one?
The main point for any car that I'm buying these days is, and now this is just personal, but I won't buy a car with any rust. Even surfacey rust type of stuff is a non-starter for me. I just don't want to deal with the monumental headache that comes with trying to properly repair that stuff. And as a fabricator, I know what goes into it and I know how much work it is. And to repair rust is one thing, but to truly eliminate it and to do it in the truly correct way, I think is the single most difficult thing you can do to a vehicle.
Yeah.
So
agreed.
That's ground one is checking for rust on all those normal rusty spots on E28s, the corner of all four corners of the front and rear glass, basically the base of those corners. I mean, obviously you can have the rocker panels, checking the license plate lights and around the trunk seal. If those are clean, typically the rest of the car is going to be pretty good. I still give it a once over, but
that's a very good tip. I think that's one of the first stops when inspecting an E28 you would like to purchase. And everyone listen to Mike, but Mike, go on.
Yeah, some people worry about mileage. I've now had 15 E28s, and I've never had one with less than 250,000 miles on it. So I think in kilometers, that's got to be getting close to, 400.
410, yes.
1,000 kilometers on every single one of them. I've never had a real low mileage one. And I don't even look at mileage on these cars. Now, to be clear, I'm only buying M30 powered cars. The M30 and its timing chain, that makes the E28 such an amazing vehicle. I think it's the most bulletproof motor that's ever been built. It is the crowning achievement of BMW. It is so utterly reliable. They go forever. So the maintenance records, I don't care about. Mileage, I don't care about. If it runs and it's not smoking and it sounds decent, even though it's probably still going to sound like a tractor, it's an M30, I'm in. Mechanics, pretty simple. As far as the steering goes, all of those steering linkages, since it has a steering box and an idler arm, a pitman arm, it's got, let's be honest, bus steering underneath it. it's probably going to be loose and sloppy. And then it's got, upper and lower control arms in the front. And so you've got all sorts of bushings and ball joints. Everything goes slack. If the car hasn't been well maintained, it's going to have a loose front end on it.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that just comes with the territory. Thankfully, you can still get most of those parts without an issue.
Yeah.
And so I just always tell myself, when you buy one, you have to do all of the front suspension right away. And it's not too hard to do if you're a DIYer, as long as you have the right tools.
Yeah.
Otherwise, it really just comes down to condition. It's just kind of, am I happy with the paint condition? Am I happy with the interior condition? What aspects of the car work versus don't work? Most likely the windows are going to be slow. Do the rear windows work at all? Does the radio or air conditioning work? And does it bother me if they don't? For me, as long as the foundation of the car is solid, as long as it has good bones to it, if it's running and driving and feels appropriate, I'm in. I think that, that's really, those are the requirements for the E28 for me.
Yeah.
Check those boxes. It's such a good, well-built car. Otherwise, you don't have to worry about much else.
I think it's a good thing for everyone who thinks about getting a BMW and a vintage one. Start with the young vintage and going back to E28. I think that's a very good start. But I think we should speak about the E36, because there's one particular car which is very close to your heart, if I may say so.
It's been a lifelong journey in a way for me at this point. I've had it for longer than I haven't, which is crazy to think.
Yeah, true. Absolutely.
And it's this constantly evolving project. I'm always wanting to, tinker with it, wanting to improve it, striving for that perfection.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes that's tough. Sometimes it's hard for me to justify spending more money on a car that, I'll never see a return on. I'm not going to sell it. I just bought new wheels for it, even though it doesn't need them. I'd like to feel like I reached a finish line and then all that's left is to enjoy it. But I also know my nature well enough to know I don't know if I can actually get there.
Okay. So that will be my question. Will you ever, or is the beauty of it to have like an ongoing project?
I think no matter what, I will try to justify it to myself as an ongoing project. I have even talked about pulling the engine out of the car and it runs perfect. It's a fantastic swap. One of the first S54 swapped E36s that was finished.
Really?
Yeah, it was. So that particular car is really what put me on the map in the BMW community. So it was in 2007 that I bought an S54 from an 05 M3. I bought basically the full M3 minus the shell. So I got the engine, the transmission, the full body harness, engine harness, cluster, all of the modules, the steering column, all of it, and swapped it into my E36. And, the community was saying, you have no idea what you're doing. You're not gonna be able to make that work. That no one's really cracked that computer yet. But I persevered, and I had a buddy, Eric Rumbaugh, who was a BMW master tech and was eager to help me figure this out. And so we dove into it, and it took us a couple of years. And then with the help of a shop up in Chicago, Fluid Motor Union, who really brought some of the loose ends together and some of the final tuning to make this car work, got this car finished. And it was, as far as I know, one of, if not the very first E46 S54 swapped car that ran with everything functional. So, if you plug into that car with a BMW GT1 head, it will pass every test. It thinks it's an E46 M3. And that came with a lot of notoriety. As soon as I finished it, I had magazine offers for magazine covers, and everybody was scrambling. This was a big deal.
And I guess this was just the motivation for you to keep working on the car.
It's almost a need to get in there and just be tinkering with it. Because if I'm not, then what am I doing with it? So will I do that? I know better than to do that, but there's still that that monkey on my back saying, hey, what if you put an S65 into it with a DCT? Wouldn't that be pretty cool? So maybe.
I don't want to use the word crazy, but I think it's close to that in a positive way. And I really like that it's never finished. There's always another challenge you want to accomplish. That's how it sounds like.
Probably the biggest financial, I don't want to call it a blunder because I'm very happy with it, but financial undertaking at least was 5 or 6 years ago. I had the whole car fully repainted. And so I took it all the way down to the body. I took the glass out of it, took every piece of trim off of it. I didn't want a single tape line anywhere. I wanted to do it the right way. And so I went to my buddy Colin, who is Axis Paintworks in Phoenix, Arizona, and collaborated with him on exactly what I wanted. I wanted the original color, still has to be granite silver metallic. I'm not a fan of color changing cars. But I told him, I want this paint job to be better than it ever was stock. But I was only looking at the cost of that paint job to get started with and not the cost of everything from replacing all of the rubber seals and gaskets, because why would I put old stuff, you know, almost 30-year-old parts back on the car if the paint is perfect? So I went through and I bought every single piece of rubber for the car. I bought every piece of trim. I bought all new door moldings and bumper moldings. And I just, I replaced every single thing that I could. New lights, new taillights, new corner lights. I mean, the only thing I didn't replace was the glass itself, because the glass was in really good shape.
Yeah.
But that drowned me financially, to be honest.
And do you visualize things? Like, do you see yourself driving down a road in Southern California while you're on working on that project? Is that something that helps also to motivate you? Or is it really for you, you're the type of person that really likes to work on things rather than enjoy them once they're finished?
If you told me I had to choose between two options, one is that I could have, let's say, any car I wanted, all the cars I wanted, a full garage, hundreds of cars, everything, anything and everything, but I never worked on them anymore, or I could build anything I wanted, but I could never drive them again, and I could never enjoy the finished product, there would be no question I'm taking the latter. The process of building is way more meaningful to me than enjoying the end product. You know, it's always tinkering, right? So,
indeed, tinkering never gets boring. But Mike, I would like to talk about your passion for the brand. You said that you are a diehard BMW fan since day one. So what would you say is the best ever BMW period?
For me, the best period is going to be the 1980s. You have the E28, which I've already waxed poetic about, and then the E30, which is such an amazing car. I mean, I've had a number of them at this point, including an E30 M3 track car that was just a blast. I mean, I still miss it.
Amazing.
You know, just such good cars that worked perfectly are the just peak of design for me. Everybody always jokes, if they know me well, I don't like cars that aren't just designed with a ruler. So if it doesn't have hard boxy edges, I'm not into it. And so it's just like, it's peak design. It's, I think it's in part probably because that's what I started liking. You know, the genesis of my excitement for BMW began with my high school girlfriend's neighbor. So when I would go over to her house after school, her neighbor had a Calypso red, late model plastic bumper, 325 coupe.
Wow.
And it had Renault LS wheels on it, had nice little chunky tires, and it had an M50 or M52 24 valve swap under the hood. And it was a part-time track car, but he also drove it on the street. I remember the first time I saw that car sitting outside, I pulled up and just thought, whoa, I've never seen that car look cool like that. In my head prior to that, you know, these 80s BMWs, this was like dated, old, you know, just kind of junky, frumpy, boring stuff in my head. I just like wasn't into it. And then I saw that car and it changed everything for me. It set off my entire career. Here I am, you know, nearly 20 years later, and it's just, I'm so excited about these old BMWs. So it's, you know, I'm sure that's part of why I would say the 80s. I think it's, again, just perfect you know, meeting of technology and the analog driving experience. And there's just so many great cars in the era too. You have the E28 M5, the E30 M3. We can even throw the M1 into the mix, which if I had an unlimited budget, M1 Pro car, greatest car of all time.
Agreed.
The E24 M6. All of these cars are just spectacular machines with so much soul. They have so much character to them. They are gorgeous. And to me, it just represents everything that BMW is meant to be. So that's no hesitation there. That's my favorite era of the brand.
I mean, understandably, one of the greatest era of that time. Also, I think a very successful one in terms of racing. And you mentioned the M1 Pro Car series, which was amazing. Not to forget the art car, the M1 art car, which is also like out of this world. So, Mike, when I speak to people of your age, that makes me sound very old, they have a particular love for the E30s. So why is that?
It's a good question. You know, I think the E30 is in the perfect place for being, in ways, the most palatable vintage BMW. You know, as we talked earlier about the E28 and the shark nose, I remember when I first got into these cars, I didn't like the shark nose. It felt antiquated to me. It looked too old. And that was before I really started to get into older cars. The E30 with its much more stand up and flat nose, and it's much more like styling that feels more like cars that would be familiar to these kind of younger generation of something like a Datsun 510 or something. It has a little bit more of that familiarity. The two-door shaped car is just, it's such a perfect little compact design. It's sporty. There's no, you know, kind of grandpa aspect to it like an E28, where it's, you know, a kid doesn't want to drive around in a four-door. That's not cool. You want the two-door. And so I think you have that aspect to it too. It's a lightweight, nimble, wonderfully driving car. It's got so much racing provenance, especially with respect to the M3. I mean, it's just, it's got all of the cool boxes ticked. And once it kind of got grabbed hold by pop culture, the E30 just exploded, because I mean, there are so many at this point, even famous musicians and these pop culture figures that are using them as, I don't even want to say fashion accessories. That sounds rude. I mean, they are clearly enthusiasts about them, but it is an accessory to what they're doing. It's even part of their identity. You know, they're in music videos and all that kind of stuff. So the E30 has just really fully saturated itself into pop culture. And so I think it does a lot of favors to itself in that regard. And that's why a lot of this really young generation is into them. When I drive my E30 around, if I stop and get gas, surprisingly, the people that are going to comment on it aren't, you know, the 45-year-old next to me. It's going to be the 16-year-old walking down the street. And he's probably going to say like, oh, that's like Tyler, the Creator's car or something like that.
Exactly.
And so it's kind of funny. It's kind of weird. It makes me feel old too, because it's like, you get it, but it's still cool.
I mean, for me, cars are really kind of time machines. They make you feel younger the older you get. And at the same time, younger people rediscover the old cars and create a new lifestyle around them. And I think that's really, really magical. But Mike, for me, more interesting at this point, looking in the future, what's on your schedule for 2024?
Well, right now, the major plans are, I've got my late friend Corey's E30 here. That one's not going anywhere. I want to get it out to the track and go beat that 2-minute lap. That's what we always wanted to do. We were having a competition with each other to see who could do it first. I've done that in the Ferrari, but I want to do that in his car. I think that would be just
cool,
a wonderful thing to accomplish and kind of punctuate that journey for him. So that's something that I want to accomplish this year. We've got the Ferrari. I need to get a new motor put in it, and I want to get back out to the track in that. I've got an Audi Urquattro that I'm trying to get finished up. I've got an engine that I'm building for it. And then, of course, we've got this big project coming, and I feel very good about it. It should be a lot of fun.
Yeah, it's the big project, the secret project you haven't talked about, and you are very secretive about it, but allow me an educated guess. I would guess you think of building something made in Europe.
I think that's a safe guess. I think you're in the neighborhood.
I mean, it's clear that we don't get any more and further information about the project, so we all need to follow Stan's works on YouTube to find out what this mystical project will be. We all cannot wait for it. Mike, thank you very much for joining tonight.
Oh, thank you guys for having me. This was a blast. I really appreciate you guys having me be a part of what you're doing here and getting to share my enthusiasm for my favorite brand. So it's been a blast. Thank you for letting me storytell and you know, diving into some of the details. It's been very fun.
Thank you very much for this. And I would also like to thank the team behind Classic Heart, because without them, this project would not be possible. Of course, not without our guests. So representing Mike, thank you very much. Then we have Federica, who is our editor, and she takes care that everything sounds right and is correct in terms of content. And we have Marcus from Scenario Studio in Munich with us, who's our audio engineer, who takes care that we sound quite well. And of course, Robin, who pulls everything and holds everything together from our agency. Thank you all for joining to this episode of Classic Heart. I really enjoyed that one. And if you like what we do here, just give us some followership in terms of subscribing or leave us comments. All are welcome. And if you know someone who you would like to hear on this podcast, just reach out, send us messages. You'll find us on all social media outlets. And let's go from here. Mike, now go to the workshop and do what you do best, creating fantastic cars.
That's exactly what we'll do. Thank you again for having me.
Perfect. Thank you very much. Bye-bye.